Welcome to the Apriya podcast series. In this episode, we talk to Suchad Chianosati, founder and chairman of SC Capital Partners, a real estate private equity firm based in Singapore. In conversation with journalist Mark Cooper, Suchad talks about the daily routine for a real estate private equity leader, what keeps him motivated, and what he looks for in new hires. We also discuss SC Capital's move into the Core Plus arena and Suchad's thoughts about the real estate opportunities across the Asia-Pacific region.
This is Mark Cooper with the Apriya podcast series, and today we have The View from Singapore with Suchad from SC Capital Partners. Based in Singapore, Suchad is a manager of an investment management firm which runs the recap series of opportunistic funds and the Core Plus, Core Plus fund. Welcome, Suchad.
Thank you very much, Mark.
So what does a typical day look like for the chairman of SC Capital Partners? I know no day is typical, really, but give us an idea about what you do for the working day.
Well, I think there were two usual circumstances. One is if I'm in the office, then I tend to go off it quite earlier. And then we usually have a whole range of meeting, conference call, and all that, and then there will be just a typical working day, just up to quite normal. But most of my time, I would say about 50 to 60% of my working hour, I actually do travel around the region, and sometimes I also do travel to outside Asia Pacific region to meet investor, and also sometimes to do the roadshow. And those days, that will be very untypical in the sense that you could be traveling, meeting, conference call. The worst date I have, and we go to four cities in the United States in one day, three cities in Europe in one day. So those, I would say, untypical day. But other than that, I mean, you know, my days are quite normal.
And for those untypical days, I mean, four cities in one day sounds a bit hectic. Are you always trying to, when you're outside of Asia, pack in as much as humanly possible into one day so you can get back here and kind of get on with the day job?
Yeah, I think we would try to arrange the meeting packed together. And typical meeting would be about an hour and a half. So we could pack about four or five or six meetings in a day. We will try to do that. But at the same time, when I'm traveling, you also remember that I do have a day work in Singapore here where the typical day is still quite full. So after the day meeting with the time differences, I still have to attend to whatever I need to attend to the best on Singapore working hour.
So there's no escape, basically.
It's kind of a little hard to escape.
Okay, so you're a market veteran, and you're still at it hard after 15 years with your own firm, and obviously a career before that. So, what keeps you motivated? What keeps you wanting to do those 40 cities in a day meetings?
Without sounding like a very standard answer, I would say I think there were probably two things that really kept me motivated. One was the desire to want to be a good investor, and that motivated me to going to looking for opportunity whenever they could be, and then go to different places. Traveling with a short notice, able to meeting with people so that we can negotiate structure and strike the deal, and also understanding with industry in depth so that we could go in and start making some good risk-adjusted investment. So that always keep me interesting. My background, I came from the my early career was on the proprietary trading, and there you're sitting on the desk, and then you're basically just looking at the screen, and you have 24, sometimes 20 instruments, and for you to trade short, long, you know, then you do some risk management. At that moment in time, I remember what kept me motivated with it, and no different from today, but the fact that I try to looking for opportunity where people have been seeing it, and also, you know, some even financial market considered to be efficient, you still sometimes see people expectation could be out of whack with the market expectation to creating you some opportunity to be able to make money. So I think that always motivated me at the investment and being a good investment. The second thing that really motivated me was the fact that we were able to be very fortunate position where we could be tasked and be trusted to manage institutional capital. And this institutional capital, very typically endowment foundations, public pension plans, some, you know, charitable organizations and insurance company and that. So we're managing their money, and as a result of it, I see that as a privilege. And in order to be able to keep your privilege, you must do a couple of things. One is you must be willing to be subject to the very high standard of scrutiny. Fiduciary responsibility must be the third in your priority. The second thing that really, really motivated me was to be able to work with a younger group of people. And you have today, you have many very bright young that would lead to some mentoring, and I love to mentor them. I love to, you know, work with them when we had a problem. I like to hear what their thoughts are, what their chain of thoughts are, and then ultimately to really work with them and guide them and toward the right path. So I think that really motivated me, and the second part of that ultimately end up with kind of creating a better firm for us. So I think in many ways, maybe a bit of a selfish on my part, that I like to have good and younger staff working for me. Therefore, the firm get to carry on even post after when I'm retired or some sort. Not anytime soon, but that's the idea. So if you ask me what would that 15 year that kept me really, really going every day, what looking for good investment opportunity, be able to sidestep the market when the market is too expensive, go to another market looking for some opportunity that the rough diamonds, to be able to really find a good sector, new sector to go into, nurture the younger staff, and therefore building a platform like the way that we have been building up for the last 15 years. That really, really very satisfying.
Okay, great. So it's almost the responsibilities that you have towards investors and staff are what keeps you going more than directly what's in it for you.
Yeah, I think that it is keep me going, and we know that if we do the right things, investor will always support that. And of course, if we do the wrong thing, we do not deserve to be supported by the investor. So I think that also kept me straight on the right path, and I think that understanding of that is very, very important.
And what if anything, keeps you awake at night? Not necessarily work things, but what if you're inclined to worry, would be inclined to worry about?
I mean, on the normal perspective, in terms of day-to-day of the world, you always wonder what is going to be the next COVID-19. What could be black swan events? What is going to come out from Woodward and to surprises you? And then the world is in such place that you always have this coming, maybe a different scale. In some of it could be large, some of it could be small. But at the end of the day, you always wonder what's going to hit you next. Okay, so I think that's always a concern that I have. But in terms of the investment, also the same thing. You just wonder what sort of big black swan event, what is that going to impact your asset, your portfolio, and your return that you can deliver to investor. And also, more importantly, whether we as a group have done anything in our ability to do so to kind of have had a certain structure in terms of risk profile that when the unexpected event happened, there will be enough buffer in that to allow us to survive and continue to make company and to keep the principal investment back to our investor. So I think that is always keep me worried at night, you know. And then I think it's good to be scared, because if you're not scared, then you don't really not good at managing risk. I think if you're scared and you're respectful of the risk, you always be think about what to do and your liability profile, tenant mixes, business interruption insurance that you think about buying, and all this thing will be building up so that if there are any unexpected events, we know that there'll be, you know, step one, there'll be gate two, there'll be step three that we can go to before that challenging our principal return. So that is something that I'm always worried whether I've done enough in terms of creating the buffer in our underwriting. I think that's something that I'm always concerned with. That's it.
Okay, so it's kind of keeping that, keeping the firm and the investments resilient and having enough, not quite redundancy, but like you say, enough of a buffer to protect you from the unexpected.
And of course, sometimes you look at the personal, you just want to make sure that everyone in your organization, because we are today, SCA Capital Partner globally, just under 48 person, if you really think about it, we had about 200 to 300 immediate family members out of that 48 people. And anything that happened to those will always be impactful to our colleague ability to perform. And also we need to make sure when something negative happened within the family of my colleague, all other part of the organization will step up and then will help to take over the load so that he or she can really spend more time dealing with a family crisis of some sort. So this thing also concerned me a lot, because we have built up any resilience within the organization. And also the future pipeline of our leader.
Okay. Now, something that's been a bit of a change for the company in recent years is that you branched out from opportunistic funds into the core plus arena with an open-ended fund. So obviously that's a change of style. What do you need to do with the firm and with your thinking to make this different type of vehicle work?
Yeah, I think for us, it was about 4.5 years ago that when we decided that we would probably we would like to at that time to go into what I call the barbell strategy. Barbell strategy in this case is actually we have one end, the opportunistic, fairly higher returns, also taking higher risk. And then to have another strategy that's on the core side with the lower risk, the return is much more stable. So I think we decide to have these two rather than being the center and being a value added. And therefore, I have the ability to do some core plus and some opportunistic. The driven strategy behind it were to avoid a clear conflict of interest. I think sometimes, during certain circumstances, you could have capital generating assets and be able to buy it at a good prices. And then you wonder, how come that not the core, right? So I think we just want to make sure that opportunity and the core strategy is vastly different, that it's going to be run by two independent capable team, and therefore everything else will not be a conflict between the two. We want to make sure that there isn't a conflict in our inherited businesses. So that's what we branch it into. And the open end nature, actually the core plus fund that we had initially was at the closed end, because we did not want to take the cash by normal open end and end up the core fund had a lot of cash, and that cash is actually dragging down the returns. So for artists, we also made sure that the cat that we kept in the fund. It's not high, so we decided initially set up the closed end funds. And when 95% of that closed end fund was invested, we have a certain sizable asset, the gross asset values. Today, our JV of the core fund is about $790 million. It's sizable, very diversified portfolio invested in 6 different countries. We then convert into an open-end fund to welcome new investors. And that open-end fund, we also have quite a relatively sticky gate, in the sense that, you know, you could open-end, but it's not a weekly traded, weekly acceptable fund. They actually do require some notice, so we have time not to having to force sell our property or keeping too much cash in the portfolio to make the redemption. So that kind of thing we have built it into the profile, so the investor knew that we wouldn't be keeping too much cash in the portfolio, and neither will we have to force sell our hotel or our asset, sorry, not hotel, our office, at a short notice, so that to satisfy the redemption. So I think we do it in such a way that much more planned. So the reason for setting up an kind of core fund is also informational. I do believe that information is very important to business like ours. So if you do an opportunistic type of fund, you do a certain segment type, sector type, and different sort of investment, you have a certain set of information. But if you don't go into the core or stay in touch with the core, for that matter, on the REIT side, you'll lose out a lot of information. So many of our opportunistic is actually built to core. Anyway, at the end of the day, you know, we do some construction development and went into the core. So for us to understand where core are trading, what core market is doing, we believe that we will help out an organization serve our investor well. And that was real driven reason for that, more than anything else. And then how to make this kind of vehicle work, that, you know, you need a good leadership. We have Jyoti that have been provided leadership, and also good old underwriting standards have to be quite high, making sure that we don't put in anything that is dreamy in nature, and be realistic in your underwriting, and working hard to search the opportunity with an outside return. So that's going to make it work.
Okay, you know, you talked about the sort of the new staff that you brought in for the new strategy, and obviously you also say that you've got a fairly young team and like bringing on new people. What do you look for in new hires? I mean, and I'm thinking kind of aside from the obvious skills and experience that are required for a position, but what's the extra things that make you hire someone?
If I have to mention 3 quality of staff that come to our organization that must have. One, it has to be driven. Driven in this, then it has to be a positive type of driven. In the sense that you have some people that are driven to basically drive everybody crazy. That's not the driven, what I really meant. What I really mean of driven is that they're motivated, they're keen on coming to work. They're young, they're keen to learn. If they're slightly more experienced, they're keen on going out and getting opportunity, making sure living no stone unturned. So that's one. The second one is important, is actually this person must be, the integrity standard must be extremely high, because we are managing other people's capital. So we have institutional investors support us. Of course, some of the money is also our own, but a lot of the money actually comes from institutional pension fund, endowment, and all that. So I think integrity, my colleague need to understand the type and the quality of the money that we're managing, and how we should consistently actually able to demonstrate to them that we are looking after their interest. And I think thirdly, really the quality of that is the keenness, it's the keener that they are willing to do things on the right way. So, for example, relationship with their colleague, that they wouldn't, you know, stab their colleague on the back, or they would be out there and then seriously treating our counterparty badly, thinking that we're coming from a successful firm. So a result of that, you know, they can, you know, pull their weight around and, you know, going around and being rude or being uncourteous to people. I do not condone any of that. I think people need to be humble. We are fortunate to be given the opportunity to managing a very good sort of capital. So we need to do the righteous thing. And then we need to be motivated because we've been looking after very well economically. And the result of that, why would you not want to be motivated? If you don't want to be motivated, you shouldn't be here. So this is how I would probably describe that what I'm looking for the staff motivations, the integrity, and also how they deal with people around them. That's very important to me.
Okay, great. One of the difficulties for smaller investment managers is compliance and regulation. Well, not just kind of legal requirements, but say the requirements for investors who want more information about ESG, for example, than they've ever done before. Is that a challenge for you? And how does a smaller independent investment manager cope with this burden of regulation and compliance?
I mean, at the first appearance, it may appear that it's a real burden. We have to go through that, and of course, it reflects an additional work for us. However, this regulation and compliance, and once you set it up, and if you set it up right from the beginnings, whatever they come along, the changes, it's just a marginal change to whatever the framework that they had. So you just have to have the first time you do it properly, do it right. And after that, any changes, it becomes a manageable issue. And I think I do believe that if you have a good compliance and you have a good regulation coming in, it's better for our industry to have good regulation. And it's also better for us and to protect us in terms of compliance, to make us think about a certain thing that we may not necessarily think about if there were no regulation, no compliance. So I don't see that a burden. I see that it's a necessary thing that we need to go to. ESG is a major concern. We really believe that the global environmental deterioration is real and it's here to stay. I didn't have to explain to you. I just went to Antarctica for the year-end vacation. Early 2020, actually, I went to Antarctica Peninsula, and you can see the change, the deterioration in the nature, the iceberg being melted, and the temperature changes, and you realize that it is we need to be responsible citizen and resident of this earth. So I think in that sense, we are. Have no issue with compliance. We don't see that the burden, it's just additional work, but it's a necessary work and it's a good work. So we don't have an issue with complying with that. I'm sure no one had issue complying with it, but we don't feel a burden in that sense.
And do you have all of these functions in-house, or do you outsource any of them?
We have a compliance officer in-house working closely with our general counsel in that same department. We also do engage an outside consultant. We need to do whatever we need to do to give an additional capacity, especially the new regulation that come in, the new compliance rule came in. Sometimes we also go out and seek some additional capacity. But no, we do have a full-time compliance here.
Just briefly, also, what brought you to Antarctica as your sort of holiday earlier in the year?
Well, I think it's a concern for the environment. I mean, we The fact that I had friends that went to Antarctica before, so I was fortunate to be able to follow a group of very, very experienced traveler and photographer on the trip with them. So I thought that was quite a real privilege. We enjoyed the trip very tremendously. Had it not for our friends organizing the trip, I may postpone it to the later date, but that's the history. We really enjoyed it. And we also want to see up at hand the continents that have been, you know, impacted the most by the environmental and temperature change. And I just want to see with my own eyes what had happened. And what I saw, I must say, it alarmed me and concerned me a fair bit. Not for myself, but for my future generation. I'm quite concerned that, you know, in 20, 30 year time, my children know that may not be able to see the same thing as what we're able to see today. And it deteriorates very rapidly. So the motivation is just to see what's changing in the world.
Yeah, it makes it real, brings it home, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about strategy and maybe start with opportunistic. So you raised, I think, $850 million for the latest recap fund, Fund 5. Looking around the Asia-Pacific region, which markets and sectors look attractive to fit in with Recap 5's investment period? Where do you think you might go?
In Recap 5, we have raised together $850 million, $650 million of which with fund. The other $200 million out at $850, we decided to put aside at the co-investment opportunity. If you look back, actually Fund 5 was raised sometime last year, and I have concern about the valuation of the market for the last 3-4 years prior to the COVID, that the valuation is quite high. And I actually don't see a lot of good deals and opportunity out there. So best for us to do two things. One, if you look at a Fund 3, Fund 4, Fund 5, we actually kept our leverage at a very low. So our leverage is no more than 50% on average. And if you value into the mark-to-market gain, our leverage in more of this fund is actually sometimes about 40%, so even below that for some of the funds that I mentioned. That's the only way we protected ourselves against the valuation that we think is high. So because we are not the publicly traded fund, we cannot short the market. So the only thing we can do is to build a buffer in our existing portfolio in order to protect the principal. So we have brought our leverage down. We have made sure managing our liability well. So that's our way of being very defensive. I think Asia Pacific will continue to be very attractive for the opportunistic fund and sort of the core fund for mostly real estate investment. And then we just need to know when the market is high, then we decided to invest less. And when the market is in distress, similar to like what we're seeing today, and then over the next 12 to 18 months, we do expect to see an opportunity in Asia Pacific, not just Asia Pacific, globally for that matter, but just in the area where we are active in, we see the opportunity around, and you know, there will be some good risk-adjusted return. So ramping up our investment when the market it actually had a correction in the valuation. And the sector, I must say, we have residential, we have offices, we have student accommodation, we have logistics, and then we also have retails. We also have hospitality in our portfolio. We also have independent retirement homes and all that. So we have all this sector that probably not dissimilar with other opportunistic funds. There one sector that so far that we'd like to get in, we have to be able to get a reasonable good return, is the data center. And I do think that with the e-commerces, with the 5G technology coming in, I do believe that that sector will continue to expand. But at the same time, you also have to be very careful that there are many, many technologies coming up that you can shrink in your storage of the data. It can go into a very, very small space and store a lot more gigabyte. So you also have two opposing forces. One in the demand is exponential. The other one is the technology also mean that the space required for that is not that much and therefore the cost. So you can't get too overly committed to the data center and you've only found out that being disrupted by some technology and the result of that, you actually got hurt. So I think that sector we probably, I'd say if that one sector could have thought a bit more, that probably that sector. The other that we thought more would probably multi-family rental. That probably is something that we have got involved with it in Japan, but we haven't done it on the pan-Asian basis, and I think we could do a little bit more on that. So these two sectors are something that I probably, I would have say we haven't done anything on it yet, or so much on that.
Okay, with niches like data centers, and also I guess to a certain extent things like student housing and senior living, there's obviously more of a management role ongoing and more specialism needed. And when you're, kind of real estate guys, how difficult is it to get those extra management skills in? Do you partner with people? Do you sort of deal very firmly just with the real estate aspects, or what do you do?
In terms of the asset management, we partner with people, but in terms of strategic decision making, we always retain the decision to make. So at the group, we are very hands-on, and I would not use the term control freak, but we do want to make sure we know everything that's going on at each of the property, rather than hand on everything to asset manager and they make all the decision for us. So we like to retain a decision making, know exactly what's going on. The asset manager can execute it day to day. So that's what our model tend to be. We also tend to like to own as much as we can. So if you see there are many funds probably doesn't own 100% of everything, about 90% of our transaction here, we own 100% of that. So we had about 10% where we have joint venture partner. Therefore, sometimes decision-making may be shared. But even then, shared decision-making, we want to make sure that we have ultimate decision making of that. So we're quite concerned about not be able to make any decision and leave it in the discretion of someone else. So that's something that we very very focused on.
Okay, and keeping on niches, are you a believer in the sharing economy and niches such as co-working and co-living? And I guess co-living is kind of related to multifamily residential. So something that you're interested in there. But what about the sort of sharing economy aspects?
We have looked at co-working space and even co-living transaction and all that. But fundamentally, there are no clear demonstration to me anyway, that the co-working spaces it actually end up with a higher overall system-wide demand of the users of the office space. So because of that, we've been a little bit more cautious. So if you look at office space in one market, you may have some sector of that office space that will convert into co-working space. But that co-working space results in a higher occupancy, actual occupancy for the whole entire market. I do see some increase in occupancy, but they're not dramatic enough for me to believe that this is something really very, very disruptive. I have seen Riga's model over the last 20 over a year. They perform something slightly different, but if you really strip down fundamentally, they can also consider to be a certain type of co-working space. I mean, people may think that I'm actually maybe an old-fashioned to compare Riga's model and a co-working space of very swanky, very, very very modern co-working space. But no, I'm just saying that I don't see real additional demand market overall from co-working space. And I also quite nervous in some of the co-working space model where they're actually willing to commit the very long term to take on the short term leases. So that's something fundamental mismatched between asset and liability is something that I'm probably quite concerned from a risk management perspective. So we haven't been active pursuer of the co-working space. And I must say sometimes, you know, people might make me feel like I'm a bit old-fashioned for not doing co-working space, but I mean, we don't see any fundamental economic value to us, then we just don't commit our capital to it. That's just simply what it is.
Yeah, I guess the kind of the co-working model is going to be tested pretty robustly over the next year or so. So it might give everyone a better idea about how resilient it is or otherwise compared with standard office space or standard flexible workspace that Regus and firms like that do.
Yep, I agree with that.
Okay, haven't really spoken about kind of particular markets or cities. Are there cities around Asia Pac that you kind of feel more strongly about in terms of the investment opportunities?
I think I have market where I feel it expensive or have been expensive. I think Thai markets which I know quite well, have been the market where it's been very expensive up until probably recently, have been extremely expensive, and that driven the fact that there are quite a large amount of institutional capital trapped in Bangkok. And the result of that, they just domestic capital just so rich that they're just racing for the lower deal possible very fast. So people that I do think that at some point in time, you look at the risk, they're taking the risk and the return is not really compensate them for it. And we begin to see some pressure out there. So I can tell you which market it doesn't work. Some other smaller market like Myanmar, Cambodia, and to some of the smaller market, to that extent, it's probably too small for institutional. There's not enough liquidity to be in there. And when the market turn weaker, you suddenly have the market free because there's not enough institutional capital to take you out of it. I do like the growth market like Vietnam and Indonesia. But Vietnam, Indonesia, if you can get hold of the deal and the deal is not complicated deal, then you will make money out of it because of the growth indeed quite strong. But many deals in those markets also quite complicated because of the demand is quite strong in those markets. So quite often the seller will make you take the risk that you are the foreign investor shouldn't be taking it, and you're actually not good at taking those kind of risks. So you end up, you rush into buy some deal that probably you shouldn't have done that. And so I think I'm quite concerned in that market. But in terms of opportunity, I do think that Vietnam and Indonesia are good, but they're very complicated, very complex. And you could lose money even when the market were rolling away and because of your partnership risk. So I think it's important that you understand the risk before you get to that market. I think the developing Southeast Asian nation continue to grow, the young population, they continue to have a higher than global average in terms of growth. So I do think that it's a very good production-based alternative to China. So the result of that, it will continue to have a very attractive growth sector. The capital market development is slightly behind. So I think you don't really have a lot of capital market developments. You very hard to benchmark, again, what the return that you take. And therefore, you don't really understand what the really true risk-adjusted return it could be. So sometimes you're almost in an absolute their own and analysis, and then not wanting to benchmark again. So that is challenging. But I mean, if you can work through all that challenge, Southeast Asia is a very interesting market. We've always been very popular about investing in them.
Okay, that certainly explains why there are relatively few sort of cross-border real estate investors invested in those markets, because there's quite a gap between the top-down picture of growth and great demographics and the bottom-up picture of convoluted local structures and a difficult working environment. But bearing that in mind,
I agree with that.
Yeah. How fast do you see the progress of these markets? I mean, you know, how long before your core fund is buying assets in Ho Chi Minh, as you know, as well as Melbourne or Sydney, for example?
I think because of the core fund, it is structured in open end. Because it's been open end, it only invested in Japan, South Korea, Hong Kong, Singapore, Australia, New Zealand. And it also invests in a major city, very core light product and with good liquidity profile. I think it could be a long while. I mean, if I have to make my best guess, it probably another at least 5 years before we ever look into China, looking into Vietnam, Cambodia or Indonesia, Thailand and Malaysia and all that. So I think it's going to be a while. And then the first wave of the core fund going through most likely going to be China, major city in China, most likely going to be, Bangkok could be. And maybe you could have Kuala Lumpur, maybe Jakarta, and then Indonesia. And then before you really consider to be like Vietnam and Cambodia. So it is the essentially liquidity profile that would determine when is that going to be able to call fund to go and operate it in those markets, because call fund is open end. Some point in time we need to sell the asset or buy the asset. So that profile, if you had some of those, it could be very difficult to really get out, and if the liquidity is restricted, it's probably not good to have that in the open-end core fund. So that would be my way of looking at that. And I think the other way coming to that, you also actually didn't realize that an SC Capital partner, we also a manager of a two REIT strategy. One risk strategy is actually up in Japan. We are controlling one of the largest hotel REIT in Japan under called Japan Hotel REIT. And that one had 45 hotels in its portfolio, and it's very, very well run, performing very well. The other REIT that we have is actually an office REIT based in Bangkok that had two assets and expanding. So we also had a risk strategy in addition to our core plus and opportunistic.
Interesting. I've forgotten about your REIT strategy. Tell us a bit, how easy is it to fit that that public market strategy in with a private real estate business? Do you need to have your REIT hat on before dealing with those investments?
I think the REIT strategy, because it's public in nature, so your disclosure are much more frequent, but standard disclosure really not dissimilar, not any dissimilar to our private reporting standard. Actually, our private report standard also very high. So the quality of information is roughly the same, but the frequency of the reporting, and of course you do have a lot of listing regulation control the way what you can and what you cannot do over the trading and inside trading, and also restricted list and a lot of other rules relating to that. So the compliance probably had a bit more and more work, and also different dimension to it. The public REIT is actually you need to managing the risk a lot more because the liquidity nature of the share. So if some news that come out or whatever negative newcomer in the market, your share price could go down substantially. So I think in order for that not to be not to be a stigma, it is important that investor and you and the REIT manager with very well communicated. So you need to have a regular meetings, roadshow with your investor, explain to investor that the strategy ABZ is what we're doing. And then at the end of the day, when the market situation and come up, similar to like COVID, whatever, you need to go back to them and say, okay, whatever ABC I told you, A, still apply and still executed well, no issue. B, we may be compromising a little bit. C, it totally out. And what did it mean? Variance into the DPU, dividend per unit, how did that mean? And communicate very openly and making sure your risk management, that you don't run into a problem, so you have much bigger buffer. And then while you look at the REIT had the leverage level very similar to the core fund, centered around 35 to 40%. And then because of that, you know, so because of that liquidity nature of the share, you can see share sell down substantially. And if people don't understand it, they would kind of wonder, something might happen to the company. But as long as you have communicated with your investor, and then you had a very clear cut plans, and you're able to articulate your plan and how your plan perform or underperform, the investor will understand you, so you will not lead into a situation, a negative situation. So I think it's important you have to communicate much more frequently. You need to explain your strategy, articulate them very clearly. But it's a very good information for it. So if you see the share price in the REIT, you almost on a daily basis, you know what the sentiment of the market overall in that part of the world. And sometimes the public market would much more emotional. So the result of that, we will end up with a certain action that the market collectively taken and result in a very attractive investment opportunity. And that's why we looking across all the three markets, publics, also core, as well as opportunistic, to look at them to us. It's an informational gain.
Yeah, if you're in all three types, all three sectors, then you can see a much broader spread of the market, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. And then we just need to have that knowledge in order to really be able to execute our plan and build up our contingency and all that much better.
Fantastic. That's great. Thanks, Suchad, very much. It's been really good to talk to you and been really interesting, and hope you enjoyed it too.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you for tuning into the Apria Leadership Podcast Series. We hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast. We will be back soon with more episodes featuring industry leaders and dealmakers who specialize in cross-border transactions across Asia-Pacific. If you like what you've heard and would like to give us feedback on future podcast episodes, please contact Sigrid Zialcita at sigrid.zialcita@apria.asia for more information. Please check www.apriaasia or follow us on LinkedIn and Twitter @apriaasia to get the latest updates.